You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's pod is with Rob Acton, who is the founder of Cause Strategy Partners. It's a consulting firm that connects Fortune 500 executives to nonprofit board leadership opportunities. A nationally recognized expert in nonprofit governance, Rob has trained countless professionals on high impact board service. And he has a new book. It's called Becoming a Causee: Champion Your Cause Through Nonprofit Board Leadership. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Rob Acton, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Kelly.
I have served on about a half dozen boards in my career, so this book was a great read for me. And towards the end of the book, you write something that I 100% agree with. You write, quote, "Of the countless board members I'd served alongside over the years, some were stellar, others were largely absent or disengaged, and a handful could be described as harmful to the mission. But the majority would best be described as so-so contributors." This is true and really kind of sad.
Yes. You know, I wish that wasn't the reality, but it has in my experience. You know, I served for 10 and a half years as an executive director of two different nonprofits, Cabrini Green Legal Aid in Chicago, Taproot Foundation in New York. But more importantly, I've served on a number of boards. So I've had a lot of experience to be in the boardroom. And I'm always just a little bit taken aback when I find board members who have stepped into this role to shepherd, lead, and guide a nonprofit that's doing critical work in the community. And remember, nonprofits don't play around the edges of society. We are in the middle of some of our biggest challenges. And when board members take, you know, one of these 15 or 20 seats and then don't show up or don't engage or take from the organization instead of give, it just never makes sense to me. So that's really, that's the mission that I'm on, my team at Cause Strategy Partners, and really why I wrote the book, Becoming a Causee. We really are on a mission to inspire the world's professionals to find their cause, engage, fully engage, and be a driver of impact on that cause that matters to them.
The thing I was thinking about that I think is similar is HR in business, which is, wouldn't you think that putting your resources in your humans who make up your business would be top of the mountain? And while I see some movement on that now, it has far too long been the butt of a joke. And it's like, wait a sec, these boards are responsible. These HR people are responsible for chiefly it's so strange to me that they get pushed to the side. And I don't know, like, you know, why does that happen? Has it always been the case? It certainly feels like the case in modern business as I have seen it in the last few decades.
Yeah, I mean, I do see a shift to your point, a shift in the direction of that particular stakeholder group. I feel like early in my career, which is a long time ago, you know, and I feel like we were sort of taught by our parents, you know, always make your boss happy. Don't cause waves, just get the job done. And I do feel a sense that the employee stakeholder group is recognized as much more important, much more valuable, has much more voice, frankly, in the direction of companies. So, but of course, to your point, that's supported by an HR talent development, leadership development sort of team. And those investments really matter. That actually happens, you know, it happens to be one of the core functions that my company sells into. We're hired either by corporate social responsibility teams that sort of focus on, you know, employee engagement, community involvement, but more and more, more than half the time, we're hired by Fortune 500 companies who have HR talent development, leadership development teams that are really trying to invest in the development of their people. And board service is kind of an incredible experiential leadership development opportunity. So we're, I'm not maybe as discouraged as you, it sounds like, Kelly.
I think I'm more seeing where it was and I'm pleased in terms of where I see it going. It's just sort of like, why for so long did we have to do? Indeed, reading your book, I'm like, well, this makes perfect sense because I want to jump into the book, but I do. I thought I would share my biggest impact situation when I was on a board.
Great.
So I had been sitting on this board for about 2 years. I was very young in my career, but I was wined and dined by the outgoing board president to have me take over as board president. I was a little surprised. He was older. He was very respected in his field. And I'd had a good deal of success early in my career, but, you know, I wasn't even 30 years old. So I said yes. Mm-hmm. And literally 2 weeks later, we discovered that the longtime accountant for this nonprofit had been embezzling money for probably 8 years.
Oh boy.
And she'd been spending it on the boats, gambling on the boats. So it was all the money was gone. So it was decided, because I'm the brand new president of the board and clearly didn't have any involvement with the embezzlement, that I would host a town hall by myself, and basically take questions. And it was, I think I was young enough / dumb enough in my career to say yes, but also young enough and dumb enough for that to actually be a kind of a yes and for me, because it went well. Some people came hard at me, but then what happened was people in the audience were like, why are you attacking a person who had nothing to do with this? In fact, this is the group that discovered it. This has been going on under 4 or 5 different board presidents. It's been going on under 4 or 5 different executive directors. So these people discovered and we fixed it and we ended up turning the board around and into a great success. That's and cool. I will say this, we had a war room, and because the woman who was the executive director had served in some Democratic, positions in government, David Axelrod came in and gave us crisis management advice, and he was the one who made that suggestion that I take the heat in that room. So,
that's world class pro bono advice right there.
It was totally world class. He's like, don't waste this crisis. The comment, which would come up again and again. Right, we've heard that comment. But
kudos to you, Kelly, for that level of transparency and engagement. I think that's the right way through a crisis, even though it wasn't of your creation. But to be transparent, to be open, and to, you know, communicate, I think probably was the key to that success. So kudos to you.
Yeah, I only did it because Axe told me to. All right. In the introduction of your book, you talk about a New Year's resolution you made to yourself in 2012 that backfired.
Yeah, that's right. And it really, in many ways, served as the genesis of the idea for starting my company. I was executive director at Taproot Foundation at the time. The foundation supported hundreds and hundreds of nonprofit organizations and, you know, really engaged in great causes. And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun this year, instead of when I meet somebody new, asking them what they do for a living, you know, I'd wait for them to ask me, I'd tell them, oh, I run this organization called Taproot Foundation, and we work with great nonprofits, really incredible causes. But instead of responding with the same question, I decided I'd ask them, you know, so tell me, what causes do you support? Well, it turns out that's the most awkward New Year's resolution of all time. Do not try this at home.
No.
What I found was that the vast majority I just caught people flat-footed. And, you know, they'd sort of have this perplexed look on my face. And so I found myself coaching them. You know, like, where do you make contributions? Where do you volunteer? Maybe you're serving on a board. I remember one guy sort of looked up in the air and he said, well, I like TV. Does that count? not exactly what we have in mind. But it was really through that experience that I realized all of these exceptional people that I was meeting, you know, that great jobs, working at great companies, clearly had a lot of talent and skills and networks that they could connect to causes, but they were doing nothing. They were literally not engaged in their community in any way, which felt like a real shame given the needs as we look around society that we have. And so, so I started ideating around how do we get folks with, you know, that have so much to offer to engage in the cause that they care about. And sort of that was the very beginning of Cause Strategy Partners concept, I guess you could say.
One of the things I love about doing this podcast is the kismet, the weird kismet that happens. So our next podcast is with Madeline Mann, who longtime HR recruiter, and the book, her book starts with this idea she had, a really good idea, that as she saw terrible resumes coming in, instead of just rejecting them, she would give all these people feedback. No one wanted it. Completely backfired on her. And it's this idea that it doesn't matter. We have a phrase in improvisation at Second City, which is you need to see the need to be right. It doesn't matter if you're correct or you're right or whatever. You know, people are not going to respond, especially people you don't know, with what they are going to perceive as criticism, even if it's well-intended, because they don't know if it's well-intended or not. So I love this idea that as you enter this thing, you're like, okay, you got to learn how to draw this stuff out of people, because they probably have a past story. They have an idea that they're just not rooted into. And I think the advantage you have is that from a very young age, this kind of behavior was modeled to you by your parents, and you kind of took to it early too.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I grew up in a family of public servants, if you will. My mom was a public high school English teacher, very devoted to her church and community. My dad ran for city council, ended up mayor pro tem. He was a nonprofit executive director. And so I really was sort of surrounded by cause-oriented parents. And I think I learned those values of leaning into doing good in society. And frankly, that's been the trajectory of my career. And I always say you couldn't put enough zeros on a paycheck to get me to have spent my career doing something lacking in purpose. That having a purpose-filled life has been enormously valuable and personal wealth that I can't explain, not in monetary terms, but in meaningfulness and purposefulness. So yeah, I'm thankful for the upbringing that I had in that regard, Kelly.
So you lived in Chicago when you were a part of Cabrini Green Legal Aid. Mm-hmm. That's 5 minutes from here, right? So, and I grew up in the city, and it took almost 20 years for those buildings to all come down, right?
It did.
And weren't you sort of there towards that final time? Yeah, talk to us about that.
Yeah, well, I was running Cabrini Green Legal Aid. We provided free legal services to, you know, folks who were in were low income or living in poverty. And many of our clients, you won't be surprised to learn, were folks that were being evicted from the Cabrini Green housing projects. You know, they had to move people, and one of the ways to sort of limit the number of folks that had to be relocated was to find, opportunities to bring housing actions against them. And so we had a really vibrant housing law practice, and with an incredible, I will say, record that our attorneys could go in and really, you know, provide for the rights of individuals who nobody chooses to be in public housing. That's the last step before homelessness. And so it was a critical practice, but yeah, we weren't necessarily fighting against the idea. You know, frankly, I don't think the solution to housing for folks living in poverty are to create these massive buildings and just stack people on top of each other. That's going to create social ills, social challenges. And so, the current strategy that really spreads the need out and creates mixed income housing and the like is the right one. But at times at the time, I should say, it didn't always feel like people were being taken care of or treated well, or basic even needs being met of families. And so very proud of the practice that we had at Cabrini Green.
I think one of the things I was interested in the book that does not get talked about at the board level is this idea of like different styles. And this is interesting because when you're putting together any ensemble, right, whether it's a work ensemble, a team, or a Second City show, you're not going to stack it with like all people who do the same thing. In fact, what you want is, let's think about the baseball team. You know, you want someone up top who's got some speed. You want some power at a certain point. You have some people who can't hit that well, but they're great in the field, so they come later in the order. This all makes sense. In an orchestra, you're not going to have the oboist play the harp. You have some different kinds of styles. And the ones you talk about are the helping hand, the disruptor, the reformer, the people developer. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about first what your style was that you identify? And knowing these are not sort of like, you're never stuck in one style. You cross over and it's all a spectrum.
Yeah, and these are kind of quasi styles. As you think about finding the cause that's right for you, what are the kind of organizational structures that you should be looking for? So, for example, a helping hand, that's an organization that's serving an individual and they're meeting sort of immediate needs. Think of a homeless shelter or a food pantry. The disruptor style is very focused on individuals, but at more of a systematic level. I'm not a disruptor. These are folks who are on the outside picketing and, marching and really fighting against the system on behalf of individuals. I'm a reformer, which is somebody who is operating at a more systematic level, but doesn't need sort of immediate gratification for the work that really wants to change a system and make the make it better for the macro folks. And then the people developer is somebody who is very focused on individuals, but again, doesn't need immediate gratification. Think of a workforce development program or a college bound program that starts working with kids in eighth grade and sees them through their graduation from college. They have the time, they're willing to take the time to see that change investment take place. So it's kind of thinking about how you can, as you think about finding a cause, are you looking for those that are serving the individual or society? And what's the pace of change you're willing to tolerate? Do you want to see immediate impact, or are you willing to go for long-term impact to create a more lasting fundamental shift? In fact, everyone can find out their own causey style by going to mycausefinder.com. We have a free quiz on our website where you can sort of answer 20 or 30 questions and find out what causey style fits for you.
So,
Kelly,
like,
have you taken My Cause Finder yet?
I have not taken your Cause Finder because I'm hopefully on my last couple boards right now. This is what's funny too is I'm on the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce board, and when I went to my first meeting, everyone came up and go, "Oh, you must be Kelly from Second City." I'm like, very quickly I realized I'm the only one not in a suit. So this was very, but that's why they brought me on. They wanted someone who was a little bit, different from an outside perspective.
Well, Kelly, you're talking to the wrong guy to ever agree that you're on your last couple of boards. There's no such thing.
You're probably right. One of the things that I'm endlessly interested in, because Bob Sutton, who's the professor emeritus at Stanford, his last book talked about friction. And he talked about the fact that there is always friction inside organizations. You just need to realize what is good friction and what is bad friction. Sometimes you need to slow things down. Boards do that a lot. But sometimes you do not want the friction because things need to move. Mm-hmm. There is this weird thing that has happened. I don't know if it's outside of Chicago, but inside the Chicago theater community now, two different boards have essentially shut down the theaters that they were serving. So they got into a fight with the artists who were both ensembles and couldn't find a way. And it's like, those theaters are not going. They're empty. And I don't understand, what has happened. I'm not in the weeds of it. There could be other things going on, but it strikes me as it's pretty bad friction when you blow up the entire organization at a board level. That's what it looks like to me from the outside. But I'm curious from your point, when is a board supposed to provide that friction and when are they not?
Interesting. So I think friction is never a goal in board governance. I think we want to see boards that engage in the work diligently, that are net contributors to the organization, that build a culture where they can be collaborative and work very well together towards the mission of the organization. And the board should be doing that in partnership with the CEO, who reports to the board. In an artistic organization, it's two people, the artistic director and the CEO reporting to the board. That's the world we want to create. And we're focused on finding those board members, training them up to be effective in the boardroom, and really ensuring there's that collaboration. Now, what you said at the beginning, boy, is it true that organizations go through crises. I have seen some major crises, sometimes personnel related or culture related, sometimes oftentimes finance related. Sometimes, you know, government policy is one that's coming up a lot right now in the last 3 months with executive orders. Crises happen. And so it's in that moment when you really need your board to lock arms with one another and say, we are in this together and we're going to get to the other side. Having a board chair lead that effort is really critical. And being in partnership with the CEO is really critical. But the idea of it's good for a board to intentionally create friction, I don't see that as, I can't think of a situation where I would agree with that. I do think at times boards have to make very difficult decisions that stakeholder groups won't be happy with. Sometimes a CEO is not successful and has to be let go.
Yeah.
And in doing so, that might really upset funders or the individual's team. Sometimes boards have to make tough financial decisions that shut down a program or limit a budget opportunity that's very frustrating for stakeholder groups. So boards are charged with tough decision making, to be sure. But I would hope that that was never for the intent of creating friction. It should be done very thoughtfully, collaboratively, great transparency, as much transparency as possible, effective communication and the like. It just doesn't make sense to create friction for friction's sake.
Yeah, I think good friction would be you're going off mission. You know, like, don't buy this building. This building is not connected to it or that, mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. But again, that should be in collaboration with that CEO, that executive director. And if it isn't, then you have to make that move.
Most of the huge crises I've seen in organizations actually came from a lack of transparency and a lack of communication. And, you know, if there's mm-hmm. anything I've learned over the course of my own leadership career, much less, you know, in the board space, you know, boards are not one person. They're 15 or 20 people. And so even understanding what a board is trying to say can be challenging because they're not speaking with one voice. But you have to figure out a way to communicate to the stakeholders as transparently as possible with really clear communication. Here's why this decision is being made. We understand the implications of it. This is, you know, and just providing as much information as you can. The stakeholders and the public really deserve that sort of clarity.
So for me, I think I understood pretty early on that joining a board was going to be a good move, almost no matter what, with regard to expanding my world. So my very first board, when I think back to joining it, the relationships that I made in there were lifelong. And they resulted in business. They resulted in artistic partnerships. They resulted in friendships. Mm-hmm. And then there was always like a two or three removed, right? There was an executive director or a person who was in marketing there who then moved on to another organization is like, and then slowly you just realize you have these, you know, you have strong ties, of course, but your weak ties are so important. And that totally comes from that organism. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, there was no pamphlet that was given to me that told me this. Like, I was lucky enough, privileged enough to have this opportunity extended to me, because of someone I knew. This book seems to be saying to people, you should think about this. This is an intentional use of your time. That is important because we don't always have that much time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your purpose and your, passion doesn't need to be separate from what will also help you grow your business network.
Yeah. You know, you may have noticed on the front of the book, Karamo Brown, who's host of Queer Eye, he wrote, this is a must read for anyone ready to make an impact in the world. That's what I wanted this book to be. It was a roadmap for somebody who is sort of at the beginning of their journey saying, sure, I'd love to make a difference. What do I do and where do I go? And it was really designed to help you from point A, how do you identify your cause? How do you then find an organization that's serving that cause area? how do you vet that organization to make sure that it's the right one for you and that they're really, really in a solid enough place that you want to engage? Then how do you position yourself for a board seat? How do you engage with the organization and make yourself known and move up to kind of being offered a board seat? How do you show up on day one, ready to serve and effectively understand the role of governance? And it's that whole journey. That's the book. And so that is the pamphlet, Kelly. Mm-hmm. It's more than a couple pages, but it's an
You should have written that like 25 years ago for me.
Yeah. And that was the goal of writing the book. I should say at my company, Cause Strategy Partners, we launched 10 years ago. To date, we've placed 1,500 business executives and employees on, we've placed 3,000 executives and employees on about 1,500 nonprofit boards across the United States and United Kingdom. So we've learned a lot about how to move a busy professional who has very little time but wants to make a difference from that point to effectively serving a board. And we really just wanted to take all of our learnings, put them together, and I wrote the book so we could offer the roadmap for others who are in the same position.
So we get hired by Fortune 1000 companies to do a variety of things for them. And in any of those workshops, whether it's a collaboration, a teamwork, a creativity, a leadership, innovation, whatever, mm-hmm. almost always the sort of beginning exercises that we focus on is listening. Mm. Because we tend to not be good at it. And it really takes practice to stop and not just listen for the words that are being said, but what's behind the words that are being said and what is not being said, and then asking questions, which is also not natural to us. Mm-hmm. But all of that is vital if you actually want to understand what's going on and what your positive or negative role might be in that. And that is something you talk about in this sort of enabling your own curiosity to learn about these boards and really take the time to make sure it's a good fit.
Yeah, the wrong way to approach board service is it with an executive lens. And, you know, many board members are very successful in their day job. They're running teams. They're looking at P&Ls. They're building goals for the team. They're holding folks accountable. A board seat is much more legislative-like in nature. You're not an executive in the nonprofit boardroom. You're one of many. You have one vote. You're not the person that will implement the decision on a day-to-day basis. And so an important part of board service is learning to understand how to be effective in this more legislative-like environment. And I think some of the keys are exactly what you said. Listening closely, understanding what's going on, contributing when you have something really meaningful to say that will advance the conversation, working behind the scenes to support the leadership team and the like, but not showing up with sort of it's my way or the highway. This is what we're going to do. That's not the job of a board member. And we see that the most effective board members really do lead with listening, understanding, curiosity, contribution, support, and passion, always passion for the mission.
So let's talk about fundraising and money, because this is
my favorite topic.
It is crucial, because I've never been on a board that was expecting money from me. Mm-hmm. I've been on boards that expected money from Second City, and mm-hmm. there was a tacit understanding that we would buy a table or whatever we would do. Sure. But I was asked to be on boards that were like, oh, that comes with cutting a check. And I was just like, you know, look, I don't have that expendable income. I do fine, but that's not something I'm necessarily interested in. Mm-hmm. But that, the reason someone might want me is because I come with other skill sets and connections and that sort of thing that are maybe more important than, you know, a couple thousand dollars. Mm-hmm. But for the bulk of the boards, they are expecting you to cut a check and then ask other people to cut checks. And that terrifies people.
Well, I'm going to change the way you framed that, Kelly, because I think that's a fair framing. And that's what a lot of people, that's their starting point. Organizations are not asking you to cut a check. What they're asking you to do is pave the way, create the way of generosity in raising funds for the organization. Remember that these are 501c3 organizations. They're nonprofit organizations. They raise charitable dollars. And so the idea is if the 15 or 20 people who serve on the board don't first demonstrate a charitable contribution to the organization each year, how can the organization in good faith go to the rest of the world and ask for money, financial support, right? So we ask 100% of board members to give a contribution that's personally meaningful to them. Some organizations will give you a sense of what that looks like. You know, we'd like every board member to give at least $1,000 or $500. Other organizations don't define it at all. They just say, we want to be one of your top three places where you give, or we want you to give a gift that's personally meaningful. A personally meaningful gift to Jamie Dimon, CEO of JPMorgan Chase, is different than what's personally meaningful for me, but both of us can give a personally meaningful gift. And so step one, write that check each year. 100% of the board needs to do so. You're demonstrating leadership and you're paving the way to go to the rest of the world and ask them to contribute as well. Fundraising is even scarier for most people, right? None of us are joining a board because we're super excited to ask our family and friends for money. The good news, and I spend a lot of my career demystifying this idea around fundraising. You're not thrown to the wolves. No board says, go raise $10,000 and don't come back until you do. Organizations have fundraising infrastructure in place, the 5K run, the gala, the silent auction, the end of year campaign, the crowdsourcing campaign, whole wealth of ways. And they just ask board members to sort of plug into the campaign where it feels appropriate and do what they can to help raise funds. One other thing that I want to highlight is that the primary role most board members play in fundraising is not making the ask, it's in opening the door. I think the best thing I can do in fundraising for the organization I serve on two boards is create connections between, you know, like Broadway Inspirational Voices, there's a nexus to a friend of mine who's a co-producer on Broadway. I'm going to get the executive director and my co-producer friend in the same room. I'll invite them to lunch. I'll pay the bill. And I kind of just set them loose to get to know each other and explore whether there are synergies. So as a board member, if you're willing to open your network, create connections, open some doors, you've done most of the work of a fundraiser as a nonprofit board member.
Still terrifying. and I think it is for a variety of reasons, right? Especially the world we live right now, right? Where the economic uncertainty is wild. And we don't know where our dollars are going or able to go right now. I hadn't even thought about this for the conversation in terms of this book emerging into this world, you know, right now. But it seems to me even more important because what I find is many people who have wildly different political points of view still probably agree on the basics of there are needs here. People need to get help, whether it is domestic or overseas or whatever. We're still one world. And we also believe in arts and culture, and we believe in expression and that sort of thing. That is probably less political than people think it might be, given the kind of discourse that we get. So in many ways, it's even more important right now for people to have a fully informed and vetted idea of where they can give inside whatever world they're in.
And I appreciate your pushback around still terrifying, and I get it. Chapter 7 in the book is written for the very purpose of helping make the fundraising role accessible. And it's a process. It's not something you don't invite somebody in to become a donor in the first conversation. You introduce them to the organization. You give them exposure. You help them decide if this is an organization that will be fulfilling for them to connect to. And then over time, they're developing into a donor. But I'm very passionate about the idea that the first time somebody is asked for money should not be when you invited them to the gala and then they felt pressured to give. That is not the way to fundraise. The way to fundraise is to develop a relationship between your friend and an organization that you believe they'll be passionate about in the same way you are, and over time introduce them to the work and the impact and the leadership and the outcomes, and at the appropriate time, explore whether or not they'd like to invest in the organization in the same way that you do.
So I'm curious how you've thought about this, which is the world is very different from what you and I grew up in. So I've got a 27-year-old who's a he was a tech recruiter where he was making really good money, and he chucked that to be a Shakespearean actor. So he is living in Atlanta with the Atlanta Shakespeare Theater, and he's an associate. He's doing great, but he doesn't make any money,
right?
And that generation is not where you and I. None of them think they're going to own a house, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's quite different. Mm-hmm. How do you, let's say you don't have that. That kind of income, extra income, yep, at all. Yep. Can you still be a Causey?
100%. Yes, you sure can, because board service is not the only way to be a Causey. Most organizations have a volunteer program. So find your cause and explore whether they have an operate. If your cause is around animals, most animal shelters have a volunteer program where you come in and take care of the pets and feed them and walk them. If your cause is the environment, most environmental organizations will have earth cleanup days. If it's homelessness, there are food shelters you can volunteer in. So you can give of your time, even if finances are limited. You can also contribute your skills. If you're a technology expert, wait, let me take that back. If you're a Shakespearean actor in Atlanta,
let's hear it.
There are plenty of organizations where you could contribute that talent to help earlier career, kids, for example, or earlier career professionals learn about articulation, learn about presence, learn about how you show up in an interview and put your best foot forward. You can always contribute your core skill set at nonprofits and without giving money as well. So yeah, you can be a Causey. Whatever your financial capability may or may not be, it's about giving of your time, giving of your talents, and when you can, giving of your treasure as well.
Yeah, I was pretty proud of our son, because he was talking to the artistic director and was sort of saying, I think we could reach a corporate market in terms of present skills, storytelling, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. What if we matched up some of these Shakespeare's out? And so they're exploring this opportunity, and it's like, oh, this is totally my son. Mm-hmm. But what he's trying to do is help his own non-for-profit theater be able to thrive. And they do lots of educational programming. He's doing a Kids Tempest that he's touring around Georgia with. And it's like, so your cause can be your theater company, and mm-hmm. and allowing your entrepreneurial skill along with your artistic knowledge to take it places that they never knew they could go. Mm-hmm. And, and in that also, the real service, I think, for that, especially in our world, as you probably know, because I know you're involved in the arts, is that it's hard to piece together a living with these gigs. There's only so many gigs. So the more that these artists can diversify, that they can be teachers, and that the teaching can extend beyond, a classroom. It might be a corporate opportunity. There might be video work, commercial, all that. You piece together a world when you don't want to hold down that job, because that doesn't speak to you. But what speaks to you is moving audiences. I just feel like I walked into my first gig out of college was here as a dishwasher at Second City. And it was 1992 or 1988. Wow. And I was allowed to sort of like survey the world. And then I became a producer in 92. And then, the world opened up to me, but it's harder. And I think we need to acknowledge it's harder and create more of those spaces for young people.
No question. So well said, Kelly.
All right. We always end the podcast with a yes and story. Do you got one for us?
I sure do. I'm going to go back to the beginning of my company again. I had a funder here in New York from a foundation call me in when I was at my last job and say, Rob, there are all these talented earlier career people who are never asked to serve on boards. He said, they always ask gray-haired, middle-aged white guys like me to be on a board. We've got some money, but all these younger people have so much to give. You should start a program to place these people on boards. And I said, Peter, I can't do that. My organization focuses on pro bono consulting. We don't do board placement work. I had to say no. Literally a year later, he called me in and said, Rob, do you remember when I asked you to start a board placement program? How could I forget? He said, well, I gave $125,000 grant to another organization. I will not name them. Guess how many board members they placed? And he raised his hands and formed a zero. And I said, they didn't place any board members with $125,000 grant. I remember he said goose eggs. Mm-hmm. And immediately in my mind, I thought to myself, well, I could place more than one board member just with my own network and the nonprofits that I know, but it was outside of our work. So I left. I was walking down Fifth Avenue a few days later, and it just struck me that I could do this. I'm passionate about board service. I could extend my network. I could connect with nonprofits in New York City that would need nonprofit members. But it meant quitting my job. You know, I had been a nonprofit professional. I didn't have a lot of money saved. There were lots of risks involved. But at the end of the day, I ended up calling up Peter and said, yes, I will do that. I'll quit my job and I'll start this program and we'll see what happens. And that's the most important yes and of my life. You know, that I took the risk. I always had a sign hanging over my office in my last job. I now have it looking at it right now in my living room. It says, what would you do if you weren't afraid? I always knew the answer to that question was I'd start a consulting practice. And so when the opportunity showed up, it was a moment where you either say yes and you do it, or you say no and you play it safe. And I'm really thankful I said yes.
Yeah, I think a lesson I take out of that I talk about a lot lately, which is like, I don't have a single thing in my life that's worthwhile that wasn't hard to get to.
Mm.
Whether that is raising kids, whether we just got a puppy. The puppy's not easy. But man, this puppy's the best. do I have a lack of sleep, and do I maybe smell like urine? Yep. Yes.
My puppy was projectiling out of both ends in a bag in the back of a taxi cab 3 days ago. And so, boy, do I relate to that.
Yes, right? It's like, this is no sane person would take this on. Yeah. But what you know is like, you're investing in this relationship that's going to be hopefully, you know, a decade or more long that you've got, like, and it's bigger and that, but that extends beyond that, right? It's all this stuff. So,
and I'm taking, can I make I want to connect to that and say, and it's the same with board service.
Yeah.
Right? It's not easy. You're a busy professional. You have a lot on your plate. You have a lot of responsibility. You have a big job and a family and a full life. But there's also this opportunity to do one thing more and to find your cause and to make an investment in it, commit to it in a sustained way, and become a causee. And I guarantee you, the listener, mm-hmm. will have a more purposeful, fulfilled, meaningful life, having added one more thing, which is giving back to society on a cause that desperately needs your involvement, where you can make a real impact. You will be glad you did.
The book is called Becoming a Causee, Champion Your Cause Through Nonprofit Board Leadership. Rob Acton, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Kelly. It was great to spend the hour with you.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
adulthood. No one survived.